We are going to hear a lot about empowerment over the next couple of months coming up to our election. Politicians like to talk about empowering people, giving them hope, giving them something to improve their lives. But at the same time, our culture takes a lot of that empowerment away by convincing people that you really don't have a choice. You really don't have a say in what goes on in your life. You have a disease, and it's a disease that you'll have for your whole life, and there's really nothing you can do about it. It's not your fault, but there's not much you can do. That's about as unempowering as you can get. And yet, people feel like they have no say. They have no determination in their life at all. And even theologically, we can come to that conclusion that I have nothing to say. I have nothing that I have control over in my own life. Everything is already set. It's all been planned. It's all been determined ahead of time. There's nothing I can do. So what's the use? And I believe this is why we see so much hopelessness in our culture. People believe that they are powerless to do anything about their situation. I don't believe that's the case, though. And this morning, I'd like to shift our focus. We've been looking at this concept of predestination and some of the other issues that surround it. And so far, the emphasis has all been on God. We've looked at God's sovereignty. We've looked at God's foreknowledge, God's predestination, God's election. And I think that's right. I think that's appropriate because God has taken the initiative. God has done all that is necessary for salvation to even be a possibility. It's all God's doing. And it's all from God's grace. We don't deserve any of it. But there is a component that is missing, and that is mankind's choice. Now, I know there are some who would say, no, make it all of God. God does it all. He not only created us, and he not only came up with this idea of salvation and carried it out, he even chooses the ones who are saved and who isn't. Humans, they claim, have absolutely nothing to do with their redemption. That's a very extreme view, and it runs into a number of problems, none the least of which is the Bible. J.I. Packer wrote, God's sovereignty and man's responsibility are taught to us side by side in the same Bible. Sometimes even in the same text, as in Luke 22:22, it says, the Son of Man will go as it has been decreed. There's your divine sovereignty. But woe to the man who betrays him. There's human responsibility. Same verse, same sentence. We see the two side by side. Both are thus guaranteed to us by the same divine authority. Both, therefore, are true. It follows they must be held together, not played off against each other. And to be perfectly fair and accurate, J.I. Packer is a Calvinist. And he sees the balance. And that's where the truth lies. It's not either or. There's both divine sovereignty and human responsibility, and they exist side by side. Divine sovereignty doesn't destroy human responsibility. It doesn't turn humans into robots. The Bible teaches both the sovereignty of God and the moral choices of men with equal emphasis. Divine sovereignty and human responsibility go hand in hand. We must not press man's freedom to the point of limiting God's sovereignty, that's true, Nor must we misconstrue God's sovereignty as to make people mere puppets. That's also true. It's both. I like how Warren Wiersbe put it. The Bible teaches both divine sovereignty and human responsibility, and when we accept both, we find no contradiction and no conflict. No person is freer than the believer who surrenders to the sovereign will of God. To ignore God's sovereignty is to exalt human responsibility and make a person his or her own savior. But to deny responsibility is to make people robots without accountability. The Bible preserves a beautiful balance that exalts God and enables his people to live joyously and victoriously regardless of the circumstances. Did you catch that last line? Enables people to live joyously and victoriously. That's empowerment. That's the message we give as the Church of Jesus Christ. There is hope. If you don't like where your life is right now, you can do something about it to change it. And in fact, it is something we must do. So I want to look at this side of the equation that is mankind's choice. And how do we understand mankind's choice when we see all that God has done and indeed is doing? So I want to begin with the capacity of choice. The capacity of choice. The ability we have to make choices. And for that, I'd like to return to the passage Ruth read for us earlier in Genesis chapter 2. Genesis chapter 2. I'm not going to read the whole passage because she did a perfect job reading all those names. I'm going to jump down to verse 15. God has created the first human being. He has put him in the garden. The Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it and take care of it. And the Lord God commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, for when you eat of it, you will surely die." My guess is you've heard those words before. That was probably not the first time you've heard that passage. But did you notice the first three words that God said, which, by the way, are the first recorded words God ever said to the human race? According to this translation, those three words are, "You are free." That's profound. God created human beings to be free. When God created men and women, because this applies to both Adam and Eve and all of their descendants, he did not make them animals. Doesn't mean he made them plants. I know some people are referred to as vegetables, but yeah, we're not going to talk about that. We are greater than animals. Animals operate by instinct and reflexes. We have something more. We are greater than the animals. I know it's very popular in science today that man is just an animal. And there are a lot of similarities, but I believe we are a step above animals. And I believe what gives us that superior position is that God gave us a will. We have the capacity to make choices. God did not make us as mere puppets to be dangled on a string or manipulated by a hand in a glove. He didn't make us computers to be programmed or controlled by an external programmer. He made us persons who could choose the direction of their own lives. We make choices every day. I heard somebody, I don't know who counted them, but somebody said we make like 30-some thousand choices every day. Some of them are very minute. Some of them seem insignificant. But all of them reflect how God made us. We can choose. And I believe that the will, that capacity to choose, along with the mind and the heart, or the intellect and the emotions, is what comprises the human personality. The mind, the heart, and the will. Now, animals have intellect. You could argue some of them are smarter than we are. Animals have emotions. But I'm not so sure that animals have a will where they can even decide against their own instincts. But we do. We can make choices. And in that sense, we are like God. In fact, I believe that's how we are in the image of God. We possess those characteristics which God has. He gave us the capacity of choice. And giving humans that opportunity is necessary within God's plan, because if there are no options, then you have no choice. Ask the people in Russia. Oh yeah, we have elections, but there's one name on the ballot. That's not a choice. You have to have options in order for there to be choice. Without it, we're just puppets on a string. And once God invested the right to choose in Adam and Eve, they became moral beings. And there was always the possibility that they would use that power to choose to go their own way. Which, in fact, we know they did. And ever since then, all of humanity has done the same. But God, having known what they would choose, gave them that power anyway. God knew what a mess human beings would make of His creation, and He gave us the power to choose anyway. I've often thought of having a sermon and saying God is pro-choice, but I'm sure I would get crucified for saying that. He is pro-choice in the sense that He likes us to have choices. Not saying He's pro-choice when it comes to abortion. But God, knowing what we would do with that ability, gave it to us anyway. It's that important to God. In his book, The Knowledge of the Holy, A.W. Tozer writes, God sovereignly decreed that man should be free to exercise moral choice, and man from the beginning has fulfilled that decree by making his choice between good and evil. When he chooses to do evil, he does not thereby countervail the sovereign will of God, but fulfills it. Inasmuch as the eternal decree decided not which choice the man would make, but that he would be free to make it. So we don't tie God's hands by the choices we make. We do not impinge at all on God's sovereignty by making choices. We, in fact, fulfill His plan, which included the choices that we make. His sovereignty does not invalidate, it doesn't override our ability to choose. He gives us great latitude because He did not want robots who are pre-programmed to follow a certain path. I have a will. You have a will. We are independent human beings. I don't control you. You don't control me. And I know there are times where people, oh, this person controls me. No, they don't. They don't have that power. They may influence you, and you may choose to allow their influence to determine the choices you make, but you're still in control. Again, it's that myth of our culture that takes away the power and says, oh, someone else controls. No, they don't. We have the power to make choices that is never taken away from us. Unless we're put in a situation where there are no options, then we are not free. But God doesn't do that. And that choice, amazingly, includes our choice of destiny. We can choose for, we can choose against. Now, we've seen throughout this series, we can't choose the consequences. That's God's sovereignty. But we can make the choices that are put before us. God is in control. He is sovereign. We cannot stand in the way of His, well, we can choose to stand in the way of His will, but then we'll get run over by it. But we're not going to stop God from accomplishing His plan. We just choose, as we're going to see later, whether we're a part of it or not. In fact, let's go there now. The book of Esther in your Old Testament. Many of you know the story. Esther was a Jewish exile in Persia, and through a series of events became queen of Persia. But she never revealed her ethnicity. And shortly after becoming queen, there was a plot to exterminate all of the Jews in Persia. And her relative Mordecai goes and says, "Look, you got to go to the king. You got to stand up for us. You need to plead our case to the king before it's too late." And Esther says, "You can't just do that. Anybody that walks into the presence of the king uninvited, there's a death sentence unless he extends grace. And he hasn't called me in over a month." Verse 14 in Esther chapter 4, probably the best known verse in the whole book. Mordecai said, "If you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows, but you have come to such or a royal position for such a time as this." It's the end of the verse that everybody knows, right? "For such a time as this." I've heard that used countless times. And it's true. But what I want you to see is something a little bit further up in the verse. Notice what Mordecai says and what he doesn't say. Mordecai says, "If you remain silent at this time, Esther, if you choose not to get involved, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place." Mordecai is confident that God is going to come through and save his people. He does not say, "Esther, if you don't do this, you're tying God's hands and it won't get done." No way. He'll use somebody else. He has that power. He's sovereign. It's going to get done. But, Esther, if you don't stand up, you may not be part of the plan. And you may lose your life. See, we don't stand in God's way. His will is going to be done. We choose whether or not we're going to be a part of it or if we're going to get run over by it. And that's a choice he gives to us. Now, there are others who might take God's sovereignty to the other extreme and say, God predestined everything, so he's responsible for my sin. He made the choices for me, so it's really not my fault. To which Paul says in Romans 9:19, "One of you will say to me, then, why does God still blame us who resists his will?" For real? Really? You're going to say that to God? It's your fault? You made me this way. No, he made you with the capacity to choose, but you own the choices you make. And you bear the responsibility for it. God is holy. He doesn't tempt us to sin. He doesn't create sin. We choose it for ourselves, and when we choose, then we bear the consequences. But we have the capacity to choose. God created each and every one of us with that ability. Now, we need to understand that ever since Adam and Eve sinned, that ability has been corrupted. So we're going to move on to the corruption of choice. And it is true, Adam and Eve had free will. They did not have any sinful nature inside them. They were not in any way bent towards sin. They were innocent. They are the first and the last human beings, the exception of Jesus Christ, who you could ever call innocent in a truly moral sense. And there are some who would say, because of that inherited sin nature, we no longer have a free will. And I agree to the extent that our will is contaminated by sin. It's not a completely free will, but I don't go so far as to say we don't have any will at all. I won't go so far as to say we don't have the capacity to choose because of our sin nature, for reasons which I will demonstrate in a moment. It is true, though, that since the fall of mankind, our will has become self-centered. We have a selfish nature, and we're born with it. From the very beginning, we are self-oriented. We think the whole universe revolves around us. Babies do that. It's just part of being human. We have that sin nature within us. And yet, we also still retain the capacity to make choices. God holds us accountable for the decisions we make. He does not compel us against our will. He doesn't coerce us against our will. Proof of that is seen in Luke 13. It's a verse we've actually considered earlier. Luke 13, Jesus is coming up to the city of Jerusalem. And in verse 34, Luke, not John. Wondered why that didn't look right. Luke 13, verse 34. Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, you who kill the prophets and stone those sent to you, how often I have longed to gather your children together as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you were not willing. In the original language, that says, I willed to do it, but your will was against my will, and I would not do what I willed because of the perversity of your will. God has a will, but he recognizes that we have a will too, and God is not going to force us against our will to receive him. He's just not going to do it. Now, that corruption of our will is something that plagues us even as Christians. Paul gives a testimony in Romans chapter 7 that I think we can all relate to. Romans chapter 7, beginning in verse 15. I'm not going to read the whole passage, but you'll get the gist of it. I do not understand what I do. For what I want to do, I do not do, but what I hate, I do. For what I do is not the good I want to do. No, the evil I do not want to do, this I keep on doing. So I find this law at work. When I want to do good, evil is right there with me. For in my inner being I delight in God's law, but I see another law at work in the members of my body, waging war against the law of my mind and making me a prisoner of the law of sin at work within my members. What a wretched man I am. Who will rescue me from this body of death? There's the corruption. And again, can't we all relate to that? You know, can't we all remember a time when we really wanted to do the right thing and there was just like something pulling us the other way? Or temptation is there and we know in our mind, I don't want to do this. I shouldn't do this. This is really going to turn out badly. And we do it anyway. Right? Why? It's because of that sin nature. It's because of the corruption of our will. We are just pulled toward it. I like the words of one song. It says, moral depravity pulls us like gravity. And it does. It's in the spiritual sense, it's pulling us away from what we ought to do and toward those things we shouldn't do. However, we still choose. We still end up choosing the wrong over the right. It's still within our capacity, even though that capacity has been corrupted. We still retain the opportunity to make choices, and we're still held responsible for the choices we make. God doesn't force anybody to go to heaven against his or her own will. And rather than violate our personality or force our will or impose his will upon our will, he will give us up to our own willfulness. And we will bear the consequences of our choices. So you say, well, you haven't answered the question yet. How do you know you still have the capacity to choose? I mean, it sounds there in Romans like Paul was saying, I can't help it. I can't help it. I'm a prisoner. I'm helpless. I'm sick. I can't change this. Well, let's go back in the scriptures and see the command to choose. See, the command to choose is given throughout the Bible. The opportunity Adam and Eve had in the Garden of Eden was not the last time human beings were told to make a choice. In fact, you see it throughout the scriptures. In Deuteronomy chapter 30, we see some of the last words ever spoken by Moses to the people of Israel. Deuteronomy chapter 30, beginning in verse 11. Now, what I am commanding you today is not too difficult for you or beyond your reach. It is not up in heaven so that you have to ask who will ascend to heaven and get it and proclaim it to us so that we may obey it. Nor is it beyond the sea so that you have to ask who will cross the sea and get it and proclaim it to us so we may obey it. No, the word is very near to you. It is in your mouth and in your heart so you may obey it. See, I set before you today life and prosperity, death and destruction. For I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in his ways, to keep his commands, decrees, and laws. Then you will live and increase, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land you are entering to possess. But if your heart turns away and you are not obedient, and if you are drawn to a way to bow down to other gods and worship them, I declare to you this day, you will certainly be destroyed. You will not live long in the land you are crossing the Jordan to enter and possess. This day I call heaven and earth as witnesses against you that I have set before you life and death, blessings and curses. Now choose life, that you and your children may live and that you may love the Lord your God, listen to his voice, and hold fast to him. For the Lord is your life, and he will give you many years in the land he swore to give to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Notice verse 11. What I'm commanding you today is not too difficult or beyond your reach. Right there says it. You can do this. You can choose. You can make the choice. And I ask you, did this happen before or after the Garden of Eden? Quite a bit after. Even though they have corrupt wills, they can still choose. And verse 19 is the challenge. Choose life so your children, you and your children can live. God set before them a choice. He made it very clear. Here are your choices. Here are the consequences. Now choose life. And I don't believe God gives commands that we can't fulfill. That's a mind game, and I don't believe God does that to us. If he gives us a command, we have the ability to fulfill it. Choose life. You have a choice. Then in Joshua 24, at the end of his life, he challenges the Israelites. Fear the Lord. Serve him with all faithfulness. Throw away the gods your forefathers served. But if serving the Lord seems undesirable, choose for yourselves this day whom you will serve. Every single person in the nation of Israel had to make a choice. Am I going to serve the Lord, or am I going to serve these other gods the people have? And then Joshua ends by saying, as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. I am making my choice now. You make yours. 1 Kings 18:21, Elijah goes to the people and says, how long will you waver between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. If Baal is God, follow him. What's he saying? Get off the fence. Make up your mind. Choose. It's got to be one or the other. Proverbs 1:29, wisdom says, since they hated knowledge and did not choose to fear the Lord, since they would not accept my advice and spurn my rebuke, they will eat the fruit of their ways and be filled with the fruit of their schemes. What does that say? Not making a choice is a choice. When you do not choose God, you are choosing self. You are choosing the way of the world. You're choosing death and destruction, even if you don't choose. Why? Because we're already corrupt. We must choose. And for those who prefer the New Testament, Jesus said in John 6:36, I am the bread of life. He who comes to me will never go hungry. He who believes in me will never be thirsty. There's a choice. We must come to him. We must believe in him. Then he says, but as I've told you, you've seen me and still you do not believe. They were choosing not to believe. Jesus had done everything. He had done miracles. He had taught them. He gave everything to them, and they still wouldn't believe. Why? Because they had the choice. They could choose not to. And through this passage, you see where God, you know, Jesus says, all the Father gives me will come to me. Whoever comes to me, I won't drive away. So God calls people, but they have to come to him. It's both. Mankind's choice in no way interferes with God's sovereignty. God doesn't have to worry that his purposes are going to be countermanded by society's sinful choices. And God will never limit the freedoms that he has given both believers and unbelievers in order to preserve his sovereignty. He can cope with it. He can succeed regardless of the choices we make. The church loses power when God's people get out of balance and overemphasize either divine sovereignty or human responsibility. The key is balance. Both are true, but if you take one to the exclusion of the other, it becomes false. And that's really where the truth lies. It's not either or, it's both and. So if today you're worried that maybe you weren't predestined by God, you weren't chosen by God to be saved, and so you have nothing to do with it, let me assure you, you do. God did not take away your ability to choose. In fact, he challenges you. Choose this day whom you will serve. Choose life and live, not death and destruction. The choice is ours. You feel like you're just stuck in a rut and there you have no control, you have nothing to say. That's a lie of the devil. He wants you to believe that, but you can choose to change. Even if that choice is simply surrendering to God, that is a choice. And not doing so is also a choice. And I encourage you, if you have not made that decision, do it today. Do not put it off. You don't know how long that opportunity is open to you. Make the choice today. Earlier we sang the song, I Have Decided to Follow Jesus. We only sang the first three verses of that. I'd like you to turn again to number 602, or we'll have the words up here, to the fourth verse, which is in the form of a question. Will you decide now to follow Jesus. And I offer that to you because you do have the choice. You can decide to follow Jesus. Nobody else can decide for you. You must decide for yourself, but you can decide because God made you that way. So as we conclude, I'm going to ask you to stand as we sing that last verse. If you haven't decided to follow Jesus, you can do it today, and it will be the most empowering decision you've ever made in your life.